so pure. He cares only about his art. But the more I watched him and the more I experienced a career that was, if not exactly his career, some version of it, things made and extended into crowd space, the less I believed in the idea of pure art, and the more I believed in the very complex process of artists acting in ways to avoid rejection. Why wouldn't they? Rejection is a sting. It's a fist in the face. It's a bad feeling in your romantic or professional life. And maybe even more devastating creatively when what's being rejected is some fundamental piece of your being, something personal and spiritual, the grain of your own unique ideas. Artists incorporate the feeling of rejection into their personality. You come and go with success or failure, but the more fundamental dynamo of fear and failure will always be there. I forgot who first told me the balloon story, but it's extremely relevant here. It's a hypothetical scenario that tells you about a person's outlook on the world. All right, here's the story. You're standing in a field. Now, a guy drives up in a truck and hops out. He has a giant bunch of helium balloons. Easily enough balloons to lift you off the ground. The guy doesn't get lifted himself because he's wearing heavy boots. Take this, the guy with the boots says, holding them out to you. You grab them. You begin to rise. What do you do? Most people say they would let go immediately, fall 3 or 4 feet into the field, and watch the balloon shrink into the sky. But then I met a young black guy after a show, and we're talking about music and creative work and his aspirations. And I presented him with a balloon scenario. What would you do? I asked. Psh, I braced myself for that ride. He said, I couldn't believe it. Wait, so you're telling me that you have 1,000 helium balloons, and you're slowly rising from the earth. You're 5 inches into the air, 6 inches, and you can't wait to go higher. Of course, he says. No. I said, I had to explain to him all the dangers involved. Anyone else I've given this example to knows to let them go. But as it turned out, he was explaining it to me. I wouldn't let them go because then the balloons would be up in the air and I'd still be on the ground. And I always dreamed of flying. I had to ask, where'd you grow up? What was your life like? He was born in 1993. His parents were still married. Both sets of grandparents were still alive and still married. He grew up lucky. And then some. Part of the generation of black folks who grew up in a stable, encouraging, nurturing environment. He escaped the entire process of self-doubt and self-hate. What happens when you get too high? I said. With the balloons, I mean. He shrugged. Figured maybe people will come and rescue me. It was an amazing insight and one that never occurred to me, partly because it's not true. People won't come to rescue you. Ultimately, you'll have to do it yourself. But maybe there's something to the belief in being rescued. Maybe there's something to the bravery of holding on to the balloons. Maybe there's wisdom, even a callow wisdom, in the brain that keeps the hand from letting go. Setting your mind. Failure and success are just states of mind. And because they are states of mind, you can restate them inside your own mind. First, there's the question of where to draw the line around a particular creative work or experience. One of the major things about a creative life is to realize that you get to manage time and even to some degree control it. And I don't mean you get to pick how long you live, though that would be an amazing perk. I don't think I would choose immortality because I don't see how I'd be motivated to do anything if I knew that I had endless time to do it. But that's a discussion for another day. What I mean is that you get to decide to some degree what the unit of your creative life is. Think of a football game. You might have a terrible first half and then a great second half that lets you come from behind and win the game. That's what happened in 2017 Super Bowl between the Falcons and the Patriots. The first half was a failure for the Patriots, but they went into the locker room at halftime and adjusted. Then they came out and dominated their opponent. Because it's a game with set rules, there are a number of different layers of success and failure, but the end result is that the Patriots prevailed. Creativity is even more nuanced. It factors in the possibility that you may want to focus only on the first half, because you're creating a first half in which you could admire the way that Atlanta performed. Or maybe what interests you isn't just the game, but the game plus the way the players treated their families when they went home that night, in which case, and this is purely speculation, you admire the Falcons players who didn't take out their frustration on others, and Patriots players who weren't high and mighty. Those are forms of success. And you have issues with Falcon players who let their sadness and frustration affect how they treated others, and the Patriots players who partied all night while their wives and girlfriends are back at the hotel. Those are forms of failure. Or maybe you want to look only at a specific aspect of the game, such as the precise moment of executing a handoff. In creative work, this is the equivalent of noticing that your technique is improving even if the work that it's serving isn't up to snuff. The point is that as a creative person, you're in charge of the size of the work being judged. If the critics don't like this album, but they like the next one, and you want to feel that's an overall positive, that's up to you. If they like neither, but the reasons have to do with their trust in your talent and their belief that you have a great album in you waiting to come out, you may choose not to feel that as a failure either. People may say these things are mind games, that you're shifting reality around to make yourself feel better. My answer to that? Of course they are. Of course you are. That's my point. The second issue has to do with individual responsibility and how much you personally have to bear the brunt of any critical assessment of your work. Again, let's go back to football. In any team game, there's always people to share in the outcome and the consequences of that outcome. A receiver can go out into the field and do everything he's asked, but if his defense doesn't stop the other team, his coach doesn't make the right calls, his performance might be in vain. Sorry, Julio Jones, but that also happened in that Super Bowl. The same is true of a band, to some degree. When I go out with the Roots, we're all in it together. A good night is both a victory for the whole group and not a pure measure of my own worth. And a bad night is a sobering experience for all and not a pure measure of my own worth. Other kinds of artists have their own version of this. Some of my comedian friends like working as MCs. Some of my writer friends like working as moderators in panel discussions. Those are ways of being part of the team without being out in front, in the spotlight. But there are times when performers are very much up in front, when the team concept or the band concept recedes and they are standing alone, exposed with their work. In those cases, you need to return to all the other strategies I outlined previously. You need to be aware of the nutritional benefits of failure and the empty calories of certain kinds of success. But I want to end with one more point. And it's also a philosophical one. One of the best ways you can cope with the feelings of failure or the stresses of success is to embrace the simple fact. The world mostly doesn't care about you. When you're a young creative person, whether a musician or a writer or an artist, you work on your craft with no good sense of who your audience is. If you do a show at lunchtime, and 10 people show up at the courtyard to watch you sing or dance or tell jokes, that can give you a huge feeling of satisfaction. Later on, as you achieve more fame, your sense of audience shifts. You expect more people to care about what you're doing. If you put out a record and fewer people buy it than projected, if you put out a book and it sells worse than what you'd hoped, even if you tweet out something funny and it doesn't get the likes and retweets that you're grown accustomed to, you might have a tendency to panic or feel especially bad about yourself. Don't. Feel good about it. You're getting back the gift of freedom. People's silence or an audience distance from you isn't necessarily a negative review. The world is extremely cluttered. It's filled with everything. Much of what you do creatively will not land in the middle of a receptive audience. It will just fall into the world to be ignored by most people and found by a few who react strongly to it, either positively or negatively. This may not speak to your ideas of fame or celebrity, but it does speak to your ideas of creativity, whether you know it or not. Creativity needs a certain amount of isolation to improve your ability to understand connection. Creativity needs a certain amount of indifference to improve your ability to make a difference. Creativity needs a certain amount of void so that you can be content and create content. See what I did there? Healthy competition. How do you keep a balance? How do you keep swimming despite those two riptides? Part of the secret here is to always stay within the sight of healthy competition. The first story that springs to mind is from the late 90s. I wasn't a new artist anymore. I was kind of a veteran. I had been in the hip-hop game for almost a decade, which is about as long as anyone ever thought a hip-hop career would last. I was still working with the Roots, but I was starting to branch out and do recording and production work on other artists as well. This was during the period in which D'Angelo was recording Voodoo. This wasn't as long as the period that produced Black Messiah. That was a decade plus, but it was still a few years. I've talked about the way he suffered from writer's block and how he overcame it. By this point, it was entirely overcome. He was humming with new material. Lots of us were contributing to the record, one way or another, as musicians, as producers, as sounding boards. And we used to all hang out in the studio. Hours were long, but morale was high. All of us sensed that the album we were helping bring into existence would be something major. I remember one afternoon when we were working on Devil's Pie, and DJ Premier was adding his creative scratches to the mix. Q-Tip was there with us in the room, and then he was gone. He had to make a phone call, and that just left the four of us, D'Angelo, me, J Dilla, and Premier. We worked for 20 minutes, and then 20 minutes more, and then took a break. Premier said, "Hey, anyone got anything new to play for the group?" He was a little older than the rest of us, but more important, a little more veteran. Gangstar had numerous classics, and their new single from Moment of Truth, You Know My Steez, had just come out and swiftly propelled the group to their first gold album. If he was throwing down the gauntlet, that meant we had to come up to it. D'Angelo went first. He rummaged around for a cassette and found it, and played us maybe 30 seconds of a new song. 30 seconds was all he needed. I'm not sure what the song was, maybe left or right, but it was electric. The room erupted. Everybody was hooting and hollering like they'd been stung, and in a way, they were. Dilla was next. He played us Fall in Love, and a sketch of what was forming into Once Upon a Time with Pete Rock. Again, there was a huge outpouring of pleasure and excitement, and more than a little envy. Premier went third. He staged the whole thing, so he knew what he had in his pocket. He played Downtown Swinger 98 by M.O.P., and a rough of group poems The Legacy. Then it was my turn. That was a problem. That was more than one problem. For starters, I didn't have lots of material. I had a work tape for a song that would become Double Trouble and Things Fall Apart. There were no finished vocals, not Tariq's full performance, nothing at all for Mos Def. It was only a skeleton. But it's what I had in my bag and what I went with when the arrow swung around and pointed to me. I'll never forget that room. The walls were gray, and so was the feeling that came over the place when I played Double Trouble. If you had been a new arrival, you might not have noticed. You would have seen the same drill that followed D'Angelo or Dilla Premier, laughing, heads thrown back, legs slapped. But you wouldn't have seen the slight undercurrent of insincerity. It wasn't anything especially egregious. It was just something in the posture of the other guys. It seemed steady. They kept a straight stare on their eyes, looking out into the middle distance, and bob their heads a little bit. They didn't even make eye contact with me or each other. It was the sign of death. I took the cassette out and put it back into my bag. I might as well not even been there anymore. I was as gray as the gray feeling in that gray room. That night, I went into that studio with a vengeance. I reworked that song completely. Whatever wasn't working, I took it out. Whatever was working, I made it better. I have said that I was like Glenn Close in Fatal Attraction in the sense that I would not be ignored, but it's a little misleading. I would not ignore myself. I wanted to be the equal of the others. I wanted to be able to go into my bag and pull out a song that would light up the room. Again, I wanted to distinguish between process and results. Did I do that? It's hard to say. You could argue that still, to this day, Double Trouble isn't the equal of Left and Right, at least on a first-listen basis. Tariq's verse is great. Mos Def adds a huge amount of wisdom and power. It's not a grab-you-by-the-lapels pop song, but that's not the issue so much. What sent me back into the studio to work on it was the creative motivation. In this case, the motivation was competition, plain and simple. I didn't care if the song sold 50 million copies or topped the chart. I wanted to impress the room, or at least make something that I could imagine might impress the room. This connects to the other principles I've sketched out. This is the place where the network sustains you. It's a way of shrinking the world down so that you are contending not with the million other things that are being made all the time around the clock by everyone in every time zone. You don't even want a yardstick yourself with your own long history of making things. You want to win the room. That's where your creativity has to keep humming along. It's the best form of peer pressure, the only valid way to use like minds. Staying on the track. There's another way to think of competition, and it has to do with trains. Let me explain. In late 2016, Childish Gambino released an album called Awaken My Love. Childish Gambino, of course, is Donald Glover, the actor and rapper. He first became known for starring in the NBC show Community, and then he created and starred in another TV show, Atlanta, which won him 2 well-deserved Golden Globes and an Emmy. He also recorded and released a series of hip-hop records. For a little while, he occupied a strange position in the music world. Some people were amazed at his versatility. How could a comic actor make these legit records? Other people dismissed him as a dilettante or assumed that hip-hop performer was just another role he was playing. Camp, the album he put out in 2011, got a brutal beatdown from Pitchfork, a 1.6. It gave me nightmares, and I wasn't even the one being reviewed. I won't wade into that dispute, except to say that I didn't think it was a very important one. There were cuts that I liked on his first couple of albums and cuts I didn't. Cuts I responded to at some basic level and cuts that left me cold. And then came Awaken My Love. I knew that Donald was taking a left turn in his music. He had talked about it in interviews. He was listening more and more to late 60s and early 70s funk records, particularly albums by George Clinton's P-Funk Empire and by Sly and the Family Stone. I'm talking about landmarks like Maggot Brain and America Eats Its Young, and There's a Riot Going On, and Fresh. I was prepared for a shift in sound, but I wasn't prepared for the completeness of transformation. From the second I put the new Childish Gambino record on, I was shocked. It was late at night, or what other people call early in the morning. I immediately called D'Angelo. D, I said, you have to hear this. It's the train. He knew what I meant. Only a few other people would have, but now everyone can know. When I was young and I was taking the train around Philadelphia, I would have strange thoughts about trains arriving at the platform. If a train left and I hopped down onto the tracks and started walking, how far could I get before another train came along and ran me over? It wasn't a healthy thought, maybe, but it wasn't a thought about self-destruction or anything either. I just wondered how long it would be before something else came along. As I got older, I started to turn that into a metaphor for art. If the Roots put out an album right on the cutting edge of jazz and hip-hop, we could enjoy it for a moment. We were the only kid on the platform, but there was always another train about 50 yards behind us. We couldn't turn to make sure, because it could be the last thing we'd ever see. We had to keep going and making things and stay creative, stay challenged. The reason I called D'Angelo was because of his own music. His own great music, I should say. Voodoo was a genuine masterpiece. And then he took some time, this is called artful understatement, to deliver Black Messiah, his follow-up. When it finally appeared at the end of 2014, it was everything everyone thought it would be. It did amazing things, bringing old funk and soul into the new age, keeping the spirit of that music alive, but also keeping it pointing forward. There was nothing like it, Or was there? D'Angelo thought he was the only one on the train track. And I was right there with him. In our heads, we were the only ones on that track. But when I heard the Childish Gambino record 2 years later, I knew we were wrong. We'd been camping out on that track so long, operating under the false belief, and suddenly I realized there was a 20-ton locomotive coming at us. Donald had a certain power, due to his TV platform, but also because of the distance that had passed since the works that have inspired him. No artist of his size, of his prominence, was working with the same ingredients in the same way. Half the people who brought this record never heard of Maggot Brain or Fresh. This was their way in, and it brought that music to life for them. And that was an unqualified good, but it was also a lesson in competition. I had lots of arguments about that record, that night and in the days to come with D'Angelo. One interesting one, at least for the purpose of that discussion, originated with the idea of influence, and it returns to some of the concepts I discussed at the beginning of this chapter. D'Angelo asked me if I thought the record was derivative. Of course it was, and I said so. But I also asked him why he thought he had the right to soak everything up, from Smokey Robinson to Marvin Gaye to Curtis Mayfield to Prince, and remake it in his own image, while Childish Gambino didn't. It all came down to time frame. See, in D'Angelo's mind, he was drawing on oldies, but oldies that were acquired legitimately, on the radio, in his own record collection, whereas Childish Gambino was wearing them like fashion. In my mind, that's not a good argument. You don't pick where your inspiration comes from or where your competition comes from. You are inspired by and compete with things that matter to you. Sometimes they come to you across the decades. And then there's the funny second implication in what D'Angelo was saying. He was suggesting that Childish Gambino was also, in some sense, copying him, that he was using the same set of moves to reach his audience. I told D'Angelo that I agreed with him, but that he had to realize that he was an oldies act too. That was something he didn't like to hear. But I asked him to look at the calendar. His debut album was more than 20 years old. His hugely influential second album was more than 15 years old. His innovations, the way that he understood hip-hop, the way he arranged vocals, the way he moved through a melody, have been in place for a long time. If a new artist was imitating Smokey Robinson, they were also almost certainly imitating D'Angelo. It's even more specific than that. In Richmond, Virginia, where D'Angelo's from, there's a whole micro-generation of young musicians whose parents met and dated in the period around Brown Sugar. Now, those guys are in their early 20s, and many of them are musicians. They're advancing the D'Angelo sound, just like Childish Gambino is advancing the P-Funk sound. They're imitating, but not just imitating. They're absorbing, digesting, and remaking, both representing and representing. And because D'Angelo is still active, all this imitation is also a form of competition. To me, that's a good thing, and possibly a great one. It reminds us that we're all on the same track, and that what goes around always comes around. Think about the trains. Never forget that they're on their way. Rewrite Reviews. Find a review of your work and rewrite it to say the exact opposite of what it says. No end. Life longering / persisting. Aesop has a fable, well, Aesop has many fables, but not all of them are relevant to how creativity works. Some are about the difference between strength and power. Some are about the difference between smarts and intelligence. But many of them do offer insights into the way that our mind generates and manages ideas. Take the one about the ant who saves up for the winter and the grasshopper who squanders all of his resources. We can use that to illustrate the ways that ideas shouldn't be spent in irresponsible bursts, because there may be lean times when old ideas need to be revisited. Or take the one about the frog who tries to blow himself up to the size of an ox that burst in the process. We can use that to illustrate the ways that creative competition can be destructive if you don't remember your own limits. And then there's the one where two pots, one made of clay, the other made of metal, are floating down a river. The metal pot wants to float side by side, but the clay pot wants to keep his distance because he's worried about the metal pot smashing into him and shattering him. We can use that to illustrate the principle of equal partnership and collaboration, and the fact that Aesop was a weird dude. Talking pots! But the one that comes to mind the most often is the story of the fox and the grapes. In this one, a fox sees some grapes hanging from a branch. He really wants them. He keeps trying to jump up and get them. When he can't reach them, he doesn't admit defeat, but instead starts claiming that the grapes were sour in the first place. This fable is, in the end, the only one when it comes to setting your creative course and staying on it. If you start thinking the grapes are sour, you'll ruin the entire process. The grapes aren't sour. The grapes are sweet. And you may never reach them the way that you want, but it's always worth it. Keep going. Don't give up. Find new ways in. All those cliches were true in the days of Aesop, when foolish foxes wouldn't heed them, and they're true today. The notion of keeping your head down, cliche, and your eyes on the prize, cliche, means something. It may not be something that's tremendously interesting or nuanced, but leave that to the ideas. When it comes to the process, just persist, persist, persist. It has positive effects for your ideas, but also for the entire human machine that produces those ideas. Remember, life is short. If you waste time or you turn away from the business at hand, you're going to regret it. Just look at The Yes and the Y'all, a song not by Aesop, but by his namesake, the rapper Aesop Rock. Maybe I should just give up or stop trying, but life is so uncertain, so short, I've got to keep on searching. But life is also long. And part of persisting is coming to terms with that fact. Now, early in the book, I quoted the poet Joseph Brodsky about the role of boredom in human life. Brodsky was speaking to college grads, and he was telling them to get accustomed to the idea that they wouldn't always be jazzed or juiced by what they were doing. The sooner they got their heads around that idea, the sooner they could accept boredom. And accepting boredom meant accepting a series of other things. The realization that humans are insignificant on the planet, for starters, which leads to the realization that humans must create to ward off that insignificance. Maintaining the right attitude about aging and keeping your creativity charged as you age is the flip side of that same principle. That's why I want to remind everyone that creativity is a lifelong endeavor. Practice may or may not make perfect, which is why you should never stop practicing. You could do it when you're young with finger paints and puppet shows, and you could do it when you're grown with the tools of your trade, pen and paper, brush and canvas, Core drum machine, and Pioneer DJM 900 mixing board. Developing healthy habits, as I've shown throughout the book, will keep you connected to the source of your own ideas. It may bring you some degree of fortune and fame, but you should also keep at it when you're older, long after you retire from whatever profession dependent upon your creativity. Healthy creative practices not only help people to sketch out a way of succeeding in their field, but they actually contribute to a healthier old age. That's right, listeners. Questlove's creativity plan is also a shadow plan for staying happy as you turn into the headwinds of time. The world is full of examples, but one of my recent faves is Dick Van Dyke. Remember him? He was in Mary Poppins, and also in his own sitcom, and his own old guy solving murder show. I caught a second of him on TV talking about his new book. A guy in his 90s has a new book? Hashtag career goals. He was telling the host about the habits that helped him maintain a youthful outlook. Some of them were very prosaic. Try to eat well, keep in the company of younger people and younger perspectives, laugh. But one piece of advice stuck with me. He warned against acknowledging the ways in which age limits your movement through the world. Specifically, he urged older people not to stop going down a flight of stairs just because it hurts a little. Once you start stopping, you're on your way to shutting down entirely. I like that, both as practical advice and as a metaphor for creative work. Little creative hitches and hurdles may come up at any time, but age is a different version of the same problem because it's easy to get the sense that things are beyond your control. I have aunts and uncles. I have friends who are older. I see sometimes that they move into advanced age and they slip a bit. Maybe it's hard to sit in a chair for a long time because you're aching back. Maybe it's hard to hold the paintbrush because you're arthritis. But there are mental slip-ups, too. Maybe it's hard to remember the name of that singer who did that song on that soundtrack to that movie. You're going to have to give me more than that. But you have to keep going. You have to take the stairs, even if they worry you. Realizing it's a long game rather than a short game helps you understand the passage of time better. It gives you perspective not only on your own work, but on your own identity. When I was younger, I used to get nervous. It wasn't stage fright exactly, but anxiety about what was happening. Why was I going on stage? Why was I making things? Then I was at a show, and I heard a guy talking to an artist. "You think you're special?" he said. "Everything that's happening to you has happened to someone before." That guy was right. And also, he was wrong. The way he was both right and wrong is what creativity is all about. It's about finding your own unique way of fitting into the continually repeating human experience. Nothing you do is new, but you can still be new within that realization. You are a cog in the wheel to some degree. We all are. But each of us is spinning at a rate slightly different from the other cogs. And at the same time, each of us is watching the other cogs to see how they spin. We learn from their spin, and we try to make sense of our own. That's our condition. There is species-wide programming, and then there's individuality. And the overlap between those two opens up a space for creativity. Live in that space. I'm here too. Maybe I'll see you around sometime. A note on the cover. When it came time to create the art for the cover of this book, I racked my brain. I racked other people's brains. One of the brains I racked was Rube Goldberg's. Everyone knows Rube Goldberg, right? I mean, no one knows him anymore since he died in 1970, before I was born. But everyone knows of him, right? Rube Goldberg was Reuben Garrett Lucius Goldberg. Now that's a name. And he was a cartoonist who was also an inventor, who was also a theorist of creativity. He's most famous for drawing these elaborate devices that perform a really simple task, like an 11-part contraption with a boot, a candle, a champagne bottle, and a flower that ends up switching on the television. Rube Goldberg created an entire genre in these cartoons. They are hilarious because the people always have such weird, intense expressions, and there's always some other animal drafted into service, like a bird that squawks and flies away and in the process pulls a string that opens a door that lets an apple fall into a pail that tips the seesaw. Rube Goldberg drew these machines as cartoons. Then people started actually making them in real life, building them in workshops, attaching a string to a tiny balance, to a piece of sandpaper, to a matchstick glued to a weight. When I was a kid, I remember being in museums and being hypnotized by anything that resembled a Rube Goldberg device. Some of them were in weird science museums, Some were in art museum. Whenever I encountered them, I would stand at the edge and watch the ball bearing going down the ramp being rotated, the switch flipping. Sometimes those machines, when built, did what they were supposed to do. Sometimes they did something different. Sometimes they did nothing, and a piece that was supposed to swing and hit another piece missed, or a ball that was supposed to roll down the ramp fell off the side of the ramp. That's one way I think of creativity. A blueprint inside a brain that either does or does not produce results in the real world. For the cover of this book, I wanted to explore that concept, to start with the idea of a machine that arranges pieces and parts to achieve a specific goal, and then to shift it a little bit to try to capture the complicated, strange process of creativity itself. So, where do we end up with that artwork? We ended up with what you see on the cover of the book. A machine that attempts to represent the way that a person, in this case me, has ideas. Because of that, it couldn't be a traditional machine. Traditional machines typically have known goals. They're ceiling fans, or they're typewriters, or they're Apple cores. Even Rube Goldberg machines, as complex and strange as they can be at first sight, have known goals. That's one of the main reasons that they're entertaining. Their comedy comes from the fact that they require 20 steps to pour a glass of water to turn on a light switch. They go to great lengths to travel a short distance. Creativity is different. Creativity is its own goal. A creativity machine is a machine that produces creativity, which, in a sense, is a machine that produces itself over and over again, growing as it goes. It is both concept and execution, both beginning and end, and new beginning. That's the idea that guided the cover of this book. The creativity machine that was constructed unites all my disparate interests and influences and shows them connected together by pulleys and levers and strings. There's music represented in the machine, of course, most notably by the record. But the machine also incorporates food and comedy and design, each of them working independently and all of them working together. That machine, that idea machine, does not really exist, but it does exist. There's a physical version of it that was not just created, but actually constructed. I have it in my possession, and I'm keeping it the same way that I have and keep many of my own ideas. But because this book is about making my creative process visible to others, I'm also sharing the machine with everyone else by releasing an image of it on the cover of this book. This is, in the end, one of the most interesting things about this machine. It has traveled from the flat world, where it was a mental blueprint, to the real world, where it was built, and then went from the real world back to the flat world. It began life as a concept and ended up as an illustration. That's the strange status of this image. A two-dimensional version of a three-dimensional version of a two-dimensional illustration of a four-dimensional process. That's three dimensions plus time. And that's another way I think of creativity. Dialogue between different levels of representation, different levels of ideas, different levels of complexity. That's what I tried to capture in both the image and in the writing of this book. Now, I'm going to go and start the machine, though it's been running this whole time. Afterward. Early in this book, I said I didn't know if I was truly creative. I knew that I wanted to be seen as a creative professional, but I wondered what that meant. This book has been an attempt to learn as much as to teach. One of the things that I've learned is that creativity means being in contact with the creative process. Sometimes it could be your own creative process. Some parts of this book came easily. Other parts required repeated reworking. But all were not only the ways of exploring the creative process, but examples of it. Sometimes the creative process that you explore can be someone else's process. These days, because of social media, because of how easy it is to record and broadcast a short video or a podcast, we have unprecedented access to the creative process of other people. Things that used to be far away are now closer than ever. Make use of that proximity. This audiobook is now part of that proximity. Throughout this book, My method has been to share stories from my life of working on projects to be clear about when I encountered ease and when I've encountered difficulty, when I've encountered satisfaction and when I've encountered dissatisfaction. Each story may or may not land with every listener. It's not one size fits all, but they come in all sizes. And the hope is that every listener will be reached by at least some of them. And afterward is a strange goodbye, a place for the author to offer parting thoughts, but also to remind you that the book should stay with you. My final caution, which is also an encouragement, is that the ideas, stories, memories, and suggestions in this book are only tools, and that you are the people who have to figure out how to use them. They are your hammers now, your compasses, your levels, your wrenches. When you're done here, don't just let the world return to the way it was before. I want you to make things. Make your way to the things that others have made. Make theories of your own. All the advice in the world won't help if you don't get out there and start the perfectly imperfect process of creating. Acknowledgements. So it's 2:33 a.m. and I'm sitting in bed snacking on blueberry pie while Soul Train loops in the background. It's episode 522. It's Ready for the World and Rebe Jackson. I'm currently head scratching on whose bright idea it was to make those kids dance to Anita Baker's Sweet Love like it was a fast jam. Each book I promised to turn in on time and not wind up in the same position I always wind up in when it's time to do my acknowledgements, which is in my sweats, on my bed, watching Soul Train, way past, quote, normal hours. This was when I start to forget names and ADD kicks in overdrive. Oh, look, Rosie Perez is dancing. I also know this is the first section that my loved ones read to see if I deem them important enough to think. And the answer is, absolutely, pal. I'm dedicating this book to all the creators and curators and experimenters and dabblers and producers and failures and quitters and designers and winners and losers and the resilience of my life. I literally know too many of you to name you all. But I appreciate you all for your contribution to my life. Signed, Questo. 3:29 a.m. That's right. That took an entire hour. This production of Creator Quest was produced and directed by Scott Sherry. And recorded at Electric Lady Studios in New York City by Sugar Steve Mandel. Assistant engineers, David Slitsky, a.k.a. Slitsky, Billy Comella, Gosha Uso, and Jaime Ruiz. Executive producers, Alexis Rosenzweig and Katie Ostroka. Music by The Roots. Host production by Danny Meltzer. Additional editing by Jake Nomura Weingrub. Text copyright 2018 by Amir Khalid Thompson. Production copyright 2018 by HarperCollins Publishers. All rights reserved. Thank you for listening.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.